Good morning. I'm Dale Jampgard, and I am here a week now, and will be here a couple more weeks. I'm a counselor in private practice back in Portland, Oregon, and I'm also a clergyman of the American Lutheran Church. And what I've been looking at is this whole area of wellness and the area of stress management. As you notice by the title, Stress Management as a Christian. And I liked to add that little phrase, as a Christian, because I think we as Christians, when we become aware of it, have some real resources within our Christian faith for dealing with stress and with opening us up to a healthy life. One of my concerns, however, is that often we're not very aware of our resources, and it's possible for some ways of approaching the Christian faith in a very legalistic way to add stress and strain to our life, or in other ways, trying to use our religious way of life as a way of proving ourselves. When our self-worth becomes invested in how religious we are, it can be a major source of stress. So that just being in the church does not guarantee a stressless life or a healthy life. But the resources are here in our Christian faith if we begin to probe and look. And one of the exciting things for me is, as I've studied the dynamics of stress and understanding the relationship of stress to illness, I've become aware of these resources in much greater depth than I ever was before. Now, the three sessions that I'm doing in a series here. Whenever we deal with a situation in life, we have three dimensions, basically. Our stance, the way we approach, the way we are. And that's the one we dealt with yesterday. And Jesus saying, have no anxiety about the future. In other words, you don't need to be anxious in your approach. Today we're going to deal with perspective. You can be in the same situation as another person and not experience it the same, primarily because you will see it differently. When I show movies, I say to people, no two of you saw the same movie. You each looked at it through your own filters, through your own attitudes, your own beliefs. And because you saw something different, you experienced something different. And so a great deal of our stress is related to how we see the world. And the third is that of response. Okay, we have a stance, we perceive some way, and then we act in some way. We respond and deal with the situation. And we'll deal with this one tomorrow. Now, as we think of perspective, there are two dimensions I want to take a look at today. One is, what is it do you see? What are your interpretations? What are your attitudes? What are your beliefs as you look at a situation? Those are the filters through which you look at a situation. The second is, how do you look at it? What is your way of knowing? And we're going to explore and take a look at what I mean by that. We have different ways of knowing things. And becoming aware of different ways of knowing can give us some options in how we approach a particular situation or event. Now, let's begin with this kind of a question. What kinds of attitudes or beliefs do you feel are detrimental to our health or our body or our being? What are some of the kinds of attitudes or beliefs that are detrimental?
Cynicism.
Okay.
Feeling it has to be perfect.
Okay, striving to be perfect.
Holding aggression.
Holding a grudge? Yeah.
Being critical?
Judgmental, critical?
Being consumed by your anger?
Yeah. Caught up in anger.
To let go. You know, you want to hang on to all the world's problems and somehow solve them yourself, and you can't let go.
Okay, yeah. Feeling tied to something. Either tied to problems or sometimes tied to goals or tied to objects. Tied to, say, money. Jesus says, go sell all that you have and give it to the poor. The rich man says, sorry.
Inflexible, I suppose.
Being inflexible. Yeah, a certain rigidity in approaching things. That don't, not able to see options. A tightness. Okay, yeah, these are all jealousy, guilt, some of these. Granger Westbrook was here earlier in the summer, and he was referring to Hans Selye's work, who has done a great deal of work in stress management. And one word he said that probably it underlies more damage to our health and ourselves is this word, revenge. Getting even. And notice that in a win-lose orientation of our society, if we see things in terms of win-lose, if you win, another person's going to lose, and losers usually have a need to get even. And so we never finally win in a win-lose situation because we've made someone there who in some way is going to need to get even. Now, these are some of the perspectives with which we see the world. And underlying these perspectives is a basic one in our society, and it is that win-lose orientation that we assume that each situation is going to be a win-lose situation. It's competitive. I did an experiment. Some of you may have been here last week when I shared this, but I'd like to share it again. They took a group of 9-year-old boys, some from California and some from Mexico, and they were going to do a little experiment with them. So they brought them into the room, two at a time, two boys from the United States, and they gave them a rope, each one on each end of the rope, and a knot in the middle of the rope and a line on the floor. And they said, okay, now, every time you can get that knot to pass over the line, you get a dime. On your marks, get set, go. And they just pulled for all they were worth. They just gave it everything they had. And the line went back and forth, you know, as one got stronger. And so they finished, okay, stop, and you get 50 cents. And then they brought the Mexican boys in, a pair of them, and put them on the rope. And they said, on your marks, get set, go. And they went. What was the difference? They weren't locked into a win-lose orientation. And so they could see the option of cooperation. Our boys couldn't see it, because they assumed it was competitive. That's the way these assumptions in our head about what life is like affect us. Another major assumption about life or attitude in our society is that we need to have more next year than we have this year. We need to have more tomorrow than we have today. And we are locked into, you know, you feel, if you don't get a raise, you feel, oh man, I'm wiped out. If you don't get some things more, you feel like you haven't progressed in life. Yes?
It didn't used to be that way.
No, it didn't.
Our government was forced to have us.
Well, I'm not sure.
Well, a lot.
You see, one of the things is we came to this country. We came to this country and we had a land of plenty, and we got used to getting more every year. You could go out and get land, and you could keep moving, and then how do we get more? We're locked into more and more debt so that we can keep feeding that obsession with moreness. Now, we can't afford what we have right now, so we have to borrow against the future, or we have to take it away from other nations to keep getting more after we ran out of more land in our land. So in many ways we're locked into that, and other countries where they can't, there is no more, they discovered again how to live without getting more tomorrow. They're saying enough is enough.
Why do you suppose that it is that our government would want to encourage nations? This need to have more and more,
mm-hmm.
would be encouraged by the government.
Look at all the labor contracts, you know, they figure in
But isn't it true, too, that the government simply reflects the attitude of all the people? You know, it's not just one or the other.
Okay, you're
so that the government attitude then
you're saying,
fosters this attitude among us, but then we feed it back.
Do you have an attitude of destroying the monetary system?
I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Well, inflation does it. You assume it's worthless. I've seen that happen in this world. I have. Look at Germany. Look at China. Nothing worthless.
Okay, and I guess what I hear you saying is that probably the government isn't doing anything that finally we, the people, don't say we want in some way. Because we finally vote for the people that we hear saying what we want to hear. And, yeah. Okay, now, there are some different ways then of centering our consciousness and approaching life, and I'd like to put up seven different centers, and these are not strictly in a hierarchy, but our first concern often is security, that we want some kind of security in life. Then secondly, we want some kind of recognition. I'll call this sensation. We like to experience ourselves. We like to feel things. And we might do this with food, we do it with relationships, whatever kind of makes us feel good. And then third, we want control over our situation, so we want power. Now, above that then, or beyond that, we can see a different kind of dynamic, a love orientation. The desire to give rather than receive. A different way of looking at life. Each one of these are like a window to look at life through. Love and then gratitude. Hans Selye says, as he's done his research, and he's a scientist, comes at it strictly as a scientist, he says revenge is probably the most detrimental attitude underlying our stress. And he said the most healthful attitude, the most healthful way to approach life is with the spirit of gratitude. Coming from a scientist. And throughout, you know, scriptures, give thanks to the Lord. Oh, give thanks. Repeatedly, that is, comes through. Love the Lord your God. Love your neighbors yourself. These are all strong biblical. And then conscious awareness. And this term then is not used as such in scriptures, but Jesus said, you who have eyes to see, why don't you see, and ears to hear, why don't you hear? Conscious awareness is the knowledge that we got from the tree of knowledge in the Garden of Eden. In other words, at that point, humankind became different than animals and became aware of ourselves. We are the only animal that can get, in a sense, see ourselves. We have a sense of who we are and what life is like. And with that, then we begin to have a sense of history. We look at our life. That's our conscious awareness. And finally, then, is the spiritual awareness.
kind of got squished up there.
Okay, these are called centers of consciousness. They're different windows through which to look at life. Now just imagine, if you're primarily concerned with security, if you're primarily concerned with security in this room and being safe, notice what you would begin to look at. Begin to check around and see where are the exits, who's here, how safe do they look. You'd have a way of looking at this room. Or if you were looking for sensation, let's see, who looks interesting here? Who could I get to know? Who would I like to be with? You know, you begin to look at that.
Which chair is the most
comfortable? Which chair is the most comfortable? Yeah. We're concerned with power. We begin to look at who's strong here, who's in control, you know. How can I take this session away from this leader up here and get control of things? Okay. And with love, you begin to say, who's got some needs here? How can I be of help to this session? How can I be present? Gratitude, begin to say, wow, look, at isn't this neat? The sunshine, look at these neat people here. Have a sense. Conscious awareness, we begin to say, what is this all about? We're here at Holden, we've come together. What does this mean in our course of life? How can I make use of this? What purpose does it have? And then the spiritual, we sense, hey, the kingdom of God is at hand. God is here, and he's present, and he's in charge. You see how then the window that we look through will affect the whole way we experience this situation.
And any or all of these could be functioning to some degree at any given time?
Yes. Any or all of them can be functioning. They're all valid. However, we can get stuck. And that's what the three temptations of Jesus were about. The way the temptations came is that the devil said to Jesus, if you will turn those stones into bread, then you'll be somebody. If you do this, you'll be somebody. And Jesus could have done that. And if he had done that, from there on, he would have been stuck here. He would have been stuck in proving he was okay by maintaining his security in life, doing what he needed to provide for himself. And it's when you begin to feel like you can prove yourself in some way, you get stuck. And then the second one, the devil says, hey, Jesus, you know, if you really are somebody, if you go up on that top of that pinnacle and throw yourself off, you can get God to send those angels and take care of you. You know, you'll have some sensation, some recognition. You really know you're somebody because you can get people to respond to you. And Jesus says, you know, hey, you shouldn't tempt the Lord your God. He does not accept that. Again, we can get stuck here. And the third one, what does the devil say? If you bow down to me, I'll make you ruler of all the earth. And give you all the power to control life around you. And again, he says, thou shalt worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. Now, what happens then is with the if, we can get stuck in these, where we feel like we've got to make things secure, got to get people to respond to us, get the sensations of life. We've got to eat. We've got to have money. We've got power. And Jesus deals with these, for instance, with the rich young ruler. He says, hey, go sell all that you have. He says, oh, no, I can't do that. He's stuck. He can't see a way of being free because his money is the way he is somebody. And Jesus says, you know, it's harder for that rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than for the camel to pass through the eye of a needle. Why? Because the somebody that he has is working, relatively. In other words, when you really make it, when you're successful in life, you're particularly susceptible to hanging on to your somebody that you've created, because it works relatively. Underline it, you're scared. But anyway, at that point, we can get stuck in these three and not be able then to move on to these freeing ways of being aware and conscious of life. Finally, the spiritual perspective of life. Jesus says, seek. I'd change that. But I think what he's talking about is see first the kingdom of God. If you seek first the kingdom of God is here, then all of these other things will be added unto you. Because it will change the whole way you experience life. The answer to stress management is seeing that the kingdom of God is at hand. God is in charge. Every person here is a child of God, is of ultimate value. He's in charge of the whole course of human history, so ultimately all things will work together for good if we but serve him.
You don't mean by that I will have all the power that I want.
What do you mean?
When you say that if I see first the kingdom of God, then all these things will be given to me. Well, I think you mean I'll have the proper perspective in terms of what power I need, or I'll be able to relinquish all my need for power. You don't mean that in the worst sense, the person obsessed with power will then have
if the
that.
Person is obsessed with power, they won't be here. And what I do mean, however, what Jesus seems to imply is when we are here, we have far more power and possibility than we expect.
Okay.
Or than we can imagine. That things become enough.
Yeah.
And that
not
our power
sense of needing to control people.
No. Okay. And our powers, our strengths are freed up because we aren't so stressed.
Okay.
And so it's a way of opening up to the powers within us.
You don't mean that bad things won't happen to you either.
No, I don't mean that bad things won't happen to you.
Yeah.
See, we can be in a concentration camp. And what does it mean to see the kingdom of God at hand? And it's in seeing the kingdom of God then that we can experience that most fully and be most strong within it. Yeah. It doesn't guarantee ease of life. But even in that situation, we have a sense of having enough.
Yeah, I think if you're satisfied and you have the sense of having enough, you have the most power actually, because you don't have the need to control anybody, but nobody can control you either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is not any greed involved, so nothing tempts you, and you don't need the power.
Yeah.
In other words, advertising will not affect you.
No, well, it will affect you, but if you really,
okay.
It won't control you.
But aren't you, when you are in certain situations, because of our human nature, are more likely to be under what you want to call it, stress or pressure. I mean, if one of your members of your family is deeply ill, it seems to me that I may be seeking the kingdom of God, but I'm still concerned and worried, and in the process of trying to take care of that person. I don't know. Those factors, I mean, sometimes there are things that just seem to almost overwhelm some people. You know, they're in one thing right after the other. They've gotten sick, they have economic problems, etc. There are pressures that are beginning to build in their life. I'm not sure in my own mind if stress would be bad. I mean, it would be almost inhuman or unhuman to, or maybe I'm worrying about semantics or something, but the pressure is there.
Well, if there is no stress, you aren't alive.
No.
So it's not saying there will not be any stress. But again, it's how you perceive that situation.
Yeah, I think that's good. The perspective is important.
Because, one person could feel, if my child dies, I've got nothing to live for. Mm-hmm. Well, that's an over-responsible relationship. If the only thing that person has to live for is that child, they're not seeing the kingdom of God at hand.
See, the
and then
danger
they can,
in what you're saying, I mean, it really is dangerous, is that if you say that to me after my child has just died, then all you're really giving to me is guilt. I'm thinking, I really shouldn't be taking responsibility for the death of my child, and
this is wrong for me to have that feeling. I should be seeing first the kingdom of God. You see how unhelpful that is? What I really need is for you to say to me, this is a terrible thing that your child died. This is a terrible thing. And allow me my grief. Don't deny what a terrible thing this is. Allow this. Don't trivialize it. On the other hand, say to me, God is with you. God is suffering with you. That's part of the kingdom too. Make room for that. I mean, these stressful things that happen are really going to have that power over us, and we can't deny it. And yet, I think we can also cling to the hope of knowing that it will not overcome us.
Okay. Now, if you're talking about coming with compassion, I can see it. I've talked with some pastors about saying, you know, to a great extent, our illness is an outgrowth of our sin. Now, I can help you understand that in the sense of when we start being addicted to these three things, security, sensation, and power, in the way Jesus was tempted, when we start trying to prove ourselves somebody, we create ultimately the breakdown in our health. And that's what I mean. Now, the reaction I get is that if we say that illness is somehow related to sin, that this is making people who are ill guilty, and that we shouldn't do that. Well, who is responsible? Now, in our society, we have an idolatry going. It's called, let the doctor be responsible. I'm not responsible for any illness that I have. I can go to the doctor and say, fix it up, doctor, do it to me, and you be responsible, and we will pay you whatever it takes. And that's why it's the fastest growing inflationary segment of our society. It's growing much faster than any other segment. $1 out of every $10 spent in our society is spent for health care. Because we're, I think, willing to pay anything for that kind of idolatry to get someone else to take responsibility for my health. And what we're recognizing in the research and understanding of illness now is that to a great extent, my health is a reflection of how I'm living my life, my beliefs, my attitudes, and what I'm doing in life. It is related also to how my parents lived their life and to the genetics. However, anyway, it's that I want to say clearly that having the perspective of the kingdom of God is a freeing thing, and there may be people who will understand it, misunderstand it, and experience a heavy trip around it. And also, I would not go in and say, this is nothing. I would not want to imply that. Sure, there's a great loss. And what I was implying here, though, that if a person is building their whole life, if my only purpose in life is taking care of my child, then I haven't finally experienced a relationship with God that calls me to a much larger purpose. And I'm trapped at a level at which everything can threaten me. So. Now, we could spend, it would be fun to, you know, one of the real frustrations here is having a short time and people passing through classes, so there's no time to build from one session to another. But I thought that also, in addition to just taking a look at how perspective works, it would really be helpful for you to begin to take a look at how you know things. Because there are different ways of knowing that can affect what we come to. Now, just a little bit of some of the things we've been exploring as we try to understand knowing. One is the whole conscious, unconscious, or subconscious is the term I like better, Freudian categories, which merely says that there are some things that you're conscious of that are in your mind, and that may be 10 to 20% of what's in your mind. The rest of it is subconscious. In other words, there's a whole, you never forget anything. Everything you've experienced is recorded in your mind. Your little 3-pound brain is a tremendous computer that we can no way duplicate, even though we're talking about artificial intelligence. And the subconscious part of your mind often controls what you do. So that I'm sure you've found it, where you decide you're going to do something with your mind, you say, that's a good idea, I think I'll do it, and you end up doing exactly the opposite. And you say, how did that happen? You know, what's controlling me? Well, it's the subconscious part of the mind that for the most part controls us and guides us. So that's one way of looking at it. Some popular language and popular theory says it in a little different way. There's present awareness, and then there's the internal and external recordings from the past. And TA, for instance, is a theory like this. Present awareness is called the adult. The internal programming from the past is called child, and that's the decisions and the way I experience life as a child, programming from within myself. The external programming is called parent. And again, then the whole story of TA is talking about which part of us is functioning. Sometimes we function with what we learn from inside of ourselves. We're in our child ego state. Sometimes we're in our parent ego state, acting or thinking the way we were taught by our parents or showed by our parents. And sometimes we're just plain aware of the present. Now, yesterday, we began to look at what happens when we bring ourselves into the present. Most of the tension in your body is related to these two things: past experiences, past conclusions about life. And when you let go and become aware of what's happening right now, a lot of times the tension will leave your body and you can begin to be present and feel, oh, this feels okay, it's okay to be me, it's okay for you to be you. And you begin to experience the present in a different way than when your mind is busy with this child and parent influence coming out of the past. Now, some other theory is called left brain and right brain. We have known, you know, for centuries that there are kind of different ways of knowing. And in the past, we sometimes have attributed it to a woman's way of knowing and a man's way of knowing. Well, brain research now is telling us that we have two halves of our brain and that they each function differently. The left side of the brain controls your right side. Your right side of the brain controls your left side, essentially. There are some variations on it. But now the left brain is concerned with analysis, with labeling, with language, with these kind of very focused, analytical kinds of things. Your right brain is concerned with kind of whole pictures, and where you see the context of things, see things as a whole. It's related to, like, music. Feelings are much more right brain. You have a feel for things. And your right brain is more creative. Your left brain is more analytical, figures things out. Each part then has a strength, and what we're recognizing is that it's not a man-woman thing, but that both of us, both sexes, have these capacities. However, different cultures tend to help us develop certain ones, so that men have been urged to develop their left brain, figure things out, get out and do things. Women have, with their roles and tasks, have used much more in their right brain, had a sense of things. And but what we're discovering, and what, for instance, business and industry are doing now, is training their people to use both parts of their brain, because it's out of the combination. I was talking to the Minister of Economics of India in a workshop. He says, I train my committees that when we approach a problem, we first go into kind of a relaxed, open-minded kind of approach, and we kind of get a feel for the problem, and then we let our our mind just go in terms of all kinds of options and ideas and things and ways to deal with the problem. A very loose, relaxed kind of thinking. And then, as we begin to get a feel that this is the kind of the best way to go, then he said we shift into our left brain and we figure out, now how are we going to get from where we are to where we want to be? And then we use our left brain, we say step one is this, step two, step three, step four. And so they've learned the different uses of their different brain capacities. Now, I think in our Christian language, we have a third category. And so just to give some labels, I use the word insight for left brain. We often focus with our eyes. With our eyes, we get a sense of analysis. When you look at something, you figure it out, you begin to see different parts and put labels on it. Right brain is more what we might call intuition. And the intuition is much more of an open, relaxed kind of looking, kind of a being with. The third, I use the term inspiration. And inspiration, notice the word inspire, to breathe in. In scriptures, it's the idea that God breathed into man the breath of life and breathes into man the truth of life. And so we have that verse, all scriptures are inspired by God. And it's a way of knowing that didn't seem to make sense, that men seem to know at a level that didn't seem to fit this kind of knowing. And so I think the use of kind of a deeper sensing of things. Throughout scriptures, knowing is usually referred to as knowing with the heart. And this is used in many different ways. Keep track of time here. Because I want to do an exercise with you in a minute, and this is just creating a framework for it. Jesus, for instance, says, out of the heart shall flow the rivers of living water. Refers to knowing by the heart. Heart is often referred to as the seat of emotions. And heart is referred to as the seat of conscience. So there's reference, for instance, to the hardness of heart. And the term mind is more related to the New Testament. It isn't used very often in the Old Testament. Heart is usually the term that's used in the Old Testament. With the Greek thinking, Paul uses the term mind a lot more. And this might give you a feel for some of the different way of using it from Ephesians. He says, now this I affirm and testify in the Lord, that you must no longer live as the Gentiles do in the futility of their minds. They are darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them, due to the hardness of heart. And that seems then to be related to kind of a deep sense of understanding, a deep sense of relationship. They have become callous and have given themselves up to licentiousness, greedy practice, every kind of uncleanness. And then it goes on, put off your old nature, which belongs to you, to your former manner of life, and is corrupt through deceitful lusts, and be renewed in the spirit of your minds, and put on the new nature, created after the likeness of God, in true righteousness and holiness. So both terms are used. Mind is often used more related, I think, to the left brain, to the insight kinds of activities. Heart, it seems to be a deeper underlying way of knowing, more related to intuitive and the inspiration. There's one phrase, having the eyes of your heart enlightened, that you may know what is the hope to which he has called you. Have you ever thought of viewing things from your heart? I know I hadn't. I tended to experience things essentially from my head. either head or sensations, viewed things from sensation, but haven't thought of viewing things from the heart. And let's experiment with that for just a moment. Where are we here? Okay, would you pick a partner, and preferably someone you don't know, and sit facing that person, and let's see what happens. I could talk about these things for a long time, but I think you'll have more fun if we try out some things. If you'd rather not, that's fine, but if you want to experiment with it a little bit, well, we'll see what happens. Okay, and now close your eyes. And now open your eyes and just look at the person. Okay, now close your eyes and be aware of what was happening inside of you. What kinds of feelings were you having? What kinds of thoughts were you having? Okay, let yourself remember those and we'll come back to them later. Now bring your awareness down to your breathing. And move your awareness down to your feet, your legs, where your weight is in the chair, your whole body. Have that sense that it's okay to be who you are, just as you are, without the need to do anything. Okay. And now what I'd like to have you do is let your eyes become soft, relaxed, and become aware of your heart center. And what I'd like to have you do is slowly open your eyes and let them remain unfocused and soft so that you see the whole room as well as the person that you're looking at. Your eyes are just soft, and experience that person from your heart center. Have a sense that you can see them through your heart. Let yourself know that person. Close your eyes. Be aware of what you experienced during that time. What kind of knowing? What did you experience? How did you feel related or connected? How was that different than when you looked with your eyes? How did it feel different in your body? Okay, share with your partner what it was you were aware of as you did this. Okay, please finish up. Let's come together. Just stay with your partner. Okay, I'd be interested. What are some of the things that happened? What were the differences? Yeah.
When I first looked, I was just conscious of the appearance. I didn't think as much of the person. And then, of course, as my partner here also said, when somebody looks at you and you look at them, you become sort of self-conscious of your gaze. But when you look with the heart, you look at with the person a different way. You go beyond the appearance, and you realize that you know that they just like you. I can't express it, but it's definitely a different way of looking at a person, and it would be nice if you could do it more often. Generally, we really stop at the appearance level, don't we? When we first meet somebody, we don't look at them from the heart all the time at all. It usually takes longer. You start doing that after you know somebody a little longer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How does that fit?
Right, at first, I had visited with him before the session, so I knew a little bit about him, and I was thinking, well, he's from Minnesota, and he's in the cheese, and he's married, and I was thinking of like the outward appearance of what he did, and I, too, was feeling some self-consciousness. Mm-hmm. The second, when I looked at him from the heart, I was more aware of all the people, and feeling and sensing that there's a good, strong core in here, and that he's a caring, committed man. There were words I kept thinking, am I going to be able to think of the words, the attributes that I'm now experiencing in this person?
So there's a different level of knowing the person. And what happened in your body?
Well, I was less self-conscious.
Okay.
I suspect I was more relaxed. I wasn't aware of that at the time, but I did feel more. Mm-hmm.
I felt more open the second time.
Mm-hmm. I think you'll probably find that if you make that shift from time to time. See, when you were looking with your head, you were locked in both to the left brain thinking, but you were also caught up in a lot of your programming in your head that says, you know, you better be this, you better do this, you should be this way and so forth, which is a lot of our anxiety. What are they thinking of me? What should I be doing? All that kind of stuff going on. That's what our tension's about. And when we move down into our heart and kind of sense a person, we feel a connection with them. It's much more affirming, much more embracing. And often then we just begin to relax. We say, oh, you know, I'm with, not looking at. We don't experience the separation that we do with our eyes. And we are trained to a great extent in our society to look with our eyes. And the idea, you know, we would hardly think of saying, I see you with my heart, or heartfelt, heart-centered. And what I've experienced, I was in a real intensive body-mind workshop, and I'd gone through dealing with some of my anger and rage and things that were coming out of me, and it was really a heavy experience. And after that, I just felt kind of gaping in front. I let go of so much emotion. And at that point, a person came up to me and gave me just a very warm hug. And all of a sudden, I felt just a tremendous warmth coming through my heart center. And I'd never experienced that before. And I said, oh, that's what heart warmth is. It's not just an idea. It actually happens. Now, I know some of you do experience that. Others of us probably have never experienced any real sense of coming from here, being energized and warm from our heart center. So That's something you can play with. Just all you need to do is just make a shift. Just kind of say, take a breath and say, come from my heart. See what happens. And watch how you can relax and not be so anxious and just be with. Now, what I'd like to do is have you decide who will be A and who will be B in your pairs. Do it this way. Decide who would like to be the sender and who would like to be the receiver. Okay, turn to your partner. Okay. Now, what I would like, would you move away from other people? Would you move up in here and get some space between you and other people, and sit facing directly, about as close as you can without touching. Okay, and now this, both close your eyes. And sender, what I would like to have you do is think of someone that you know well that the person that you're with does not know. Get that person in your mind. And let yourself remember things about that person. Notice, like, their coloring, color of their hair, what their appearance is like. And then think of the things that they like to do. What kind of occupation do they have? What are some of their roles in life? What are some of their interests? What is there about them that you like or don't like? What is their circumstance in life like right now? Okay. Now I would like to have you relax, take a good full breath of air. And as you relax, let an image of that person be standing right in front of you, as though that person were standing facing your partner. That person is there. And now, you who are the receivers, bring your awareness to your breathing. And now move your awareness out to the tips of your hands, your fingers, the palm of your hand, and bring your hands up in front of you with your palms forward. And I'd like to have you let come to your mind some sense of that person. And as you begin to get some idea of what that person is like, start with a description, then I want you to say to your partner, I sense or I see this person is such and such. And you who are sending, merely confirm what it is that you can about their answer. Yes, that's right, or that's not quite right. And just feedback. Do not give them more information about the person. Just respond to whatever they give you and let them know when they are accurately describing the person. And now I'd like to have you tell your partner the sex and about the age of the person that you're thinking of. Okay, and now receivers, with your hands up, sensing, just let the images begin to come to you, almost as though you could sense them with your hands. And begin to feed back to your sender what you're seeing. Okay, and now finish up and take a moment to debrief with your partner what was happening.
No, that's really good.